Israel denies it's preventing aid from reaching Gaza.
This past Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the UN requested that we close the Kerem Shalom crossing for aid inspections due to congestion on the Gaza side.
Plus, the biggest Russian air assault yet.
There are destructions of the residential buildings, a business center, warehouses, and metro station. I'm reporting this report in a bomb shelter, approximately a couple of kilometers from the site of one of the missile blasts.
And later, what would happen if Ukraine lost the financial support of the U.S.? And it was a busy year for crises. We take a look back at 2023 in Africa. Today is Friday, December 29th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russia's largest attack on Ukraine yet. That story coming up in a few minutes. Now we check in on Israel and Hamas. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, said on Friday that an aid convoy had come under fire from Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip. No casualties were reported in the incident, which UNRWA said happened on Thursday afternoon. Tom White is UNRWA's director in Gaza. He said on X, formerly Twitter, that Israeli soldiers fired at an aid convoy as it returned from northern Gaza along a route designated by the Israeli army. Our international convoy leader and his team were not injured, but one vehicle sustained damage. Responding to requests for comment, the Israeli military said it was looking into reports about the incident. All this comes as the United Nations Security Council is expected to meet Friday afternoon in New York to discuss the humanitarian aid situation in Gaza, as international bodies say supplies being let in through Israeli inspections are a small fraction of Gaza's needs. Last week, Israel bowed to international pressure to open a second crossing it said would double the number of supply trucks daily to 200, but only 76 were able to enter on Thursday, compared to 500 in peacetime, this according to the United Nations. For its part, Israel said on Friday that it does not limit humanitarian aid into Gaza and that the problem was with the UN's distribution system inside the enclave. Tal Heinrich is a spokesperson for the Israeli government.
This past Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the UN requested that we close the Kerem Shalom crossing for aid inspections due to congestion on the Gaza side. Israel continues to have excess capacity for the inspection and passage of aid trucks into Gaza, and we place no limit on the amount of humanitarian supplies which can enter the Strip. Suggesting otherwise is a fallacy.
Meanwhile, Russia has unleashed what one Ukrainian general said was the biggest aerial barrage of the nearly two-year-old full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russian forces launched 122 missiles over 18 hours with strikes in Dnipro, Kherson, Kyiv, Lviv, and more. At least 30 people were killed with over 144 injured. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that Russia launched about 110 missiles overnight throughout Ukraine. Many of the drones were shot down by Ukraine's defense systems. In Boyarka, a suburb around 12 miles southwest of Kyiv, firefighters tackled a fire caused by one downed drone. In Odessa, footage filmed by the State Emergency Service of Ukraine showed emergency workers helping residents leave a residential building in the port city. On social media platform X, formerly Twitter, Zelensky wrote, "Today Russia used nearly every type of weapon in its arsenal. If Zelensky's count is confirmed, it would be the largest aerial attack by the Kremlin's forces since their full-scale invasion in February 2022. I'm Karen Chamas.
UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk condemned the wave of Russian strikes across Ukraine on Friday. He called on Russia to cease its attacks on Ukraine immediately and to strictly respect all the rules of international law relating to the conduct of hostilities. And a developing update to this story. According to Polish officials, a missile that was part of Russia's massive barrage against Ukraine briefly entered, then exited Polish airspace. As we've heard, the biggest air attack on Ukraine since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion happened Thursday night. VOA's Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv and has more.
A massive air assault was launched by the Russian forces over Ukraine on December 29th, including 36 drones and 122 missiles of various types. This was the biggest air attack on Ukraine since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion. Beginning in the late evening of December 28, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with 36 Shahed drones targeting various regions in different parts of Ukraine. Then, around 3 a.m. on Friday, the 29th, 18 Tu-95 strategic bombers were detected in the air. At around 6 a.m., they launched at least 90 air-based cruise missiles. At around 5 a.m., the Russian forces used two 22M3 long-range bombers to launch 32 cruise missiles in the direction of the northern and central regions. At the same time, Russian forces hit the city of Kharkiv with S-300 missiles and launched at least 14 ballistic missiles from the occupied Crimea, Kursk and Belgorod regions of the Russian Federation. At 6:30 a.m., the takeoff of five MiG-31K fighters was detected, which launched five Kinjal-era ballistic missiles from the Astrakhan region in Russia. Additional four KH-31P anti-radar missiles and one KH-59 were launched from Su-35 tactical aircraft. The city of Kyiv was one of the main targets for the Russian attack. More than 3 dozen aerial targets were destroyed over the capital. As a result of the attack, at least 24 people were confirmed injured and 6 people killed in Kyiv. Rescue operations in the capital are ongoing, so the numbers could change. There are destructions of the residential buildings, a business center, warehouses and metro station. I'm recording this report in a bomb shelter, approximately a couple of kilometers from the site of one of the missile blasts. The situation in the other regions is as follows. A maternity hospital, residential buildings, and a shopping center were damaged in Dnipro. 13 residential buildings, 3 schools, a kindergarten, and infrastructure facilities were heavily damaged in Lviv. Residential buildings, warehouses, a transport depot, and a medical facility were damaged in Kharkiv. Residential buildings and business facilities were affected in Zaporizhia. Residential buildings and public infrastructure were damaged in Sumy, and destruction of residential buildings was also confirmed in Odessa. According to Ukrainian officials, at least 26 people were killed and over 120 injured as a result of this massive attack. However, the numbers could change as rescue operations in different regions are ongoing. Later in the afternoon, Russian forces conducted another missile attack targeting the Cherkasy region in the central part of Ukraine. Local authorities confirmed the destruction of 51 private residential buildings. 8 people were confirmed injured, including one child. Meanwhile, the General Staff of the Polish Army stated that a Russian missile violated Poland's airspace on Friday, December 29. Chief of the General Staff of the Polish Army, General Wiesław Kukula, stated this at a briefing after the meeting of the National Security Bureau of Poland. VOA cannot verify this information independently at this point. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
As we've heard, the attacks continue in Ukraine as the funding debate in Washington has stopped for the holidays. Natalia Churikova of VOA's Ukrainian service spoke with Mykola Belisikov, a Ukrainian military expert, about what would happen in Ukraine if the country loses Western support.
Ability of Ukraine to pursue current strategy, which envisions continuous frontline and negation of Russian advantage in piloted aviation, would be at risk. So at certain moment, for Ukraine, it would be difficult to create a certain level of risks for Russian piloted aviation and make them to keep some distance from the in-depth of Ukrainian airspace, and also Ukrainian ability to keep current frontline and to deter Russia from swift advances in depths of Ukrainian landmass would be at risk. So that's why there are two critical sets of capabilities, air defense, surface-to-air missiles, like Patriot, like NASAMS, and also artillery that are critical to ability of Ukraine to control 80% of its territory.
Ahead of NATO meeting in Washington, there were some proposals to admit Ukraine, but also only to spread the Article 5 of NATO agreement only to the territory which is under Kyiv's control. How viable is this idea in your view?
I understand the reasons why former NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen is promoting this idea. He's trying to do his best in terms of ensuring security of the territories Kyiv currently possesses. But in my opinion, this model is not viable. And the precedent of Western Germany, when it was admitted in NATO in 1945, it doesn't apply to Ukraine, because the problem is that if front line changes, like imagine Russian taking control of Avdiivka or pushing Ukrainians out of Bakhmut, maybe Kupiansk, Oaza, any other direction. So whether this is the threshold for NATO to intervene. That's why in this case, NATO position is consistent that with high intensity ongoing war, there can be no talk of admitting Ukraine into NATO, because again, the threshold for the intervention is lowered beyond certain very, very risky level. That's why, well, any attempt to bring as much security and shoulder more risks of confronting Russian aggression is welcomed. But there is very little chance that this model will work. And simultaneously, well, for Ukraine, which has a trauma of Budapest Memorandum, when we ready to surrender something and to gain promise of aid. So that's why all these ideas that, well, if you agree with loss of 20% of your territory and then you'll be admitted in NATO, for us with the trauma of Budapest Memorandum, it carries a lot of unwarranted risk, because there may be a situation when Ukraine, again, very hypothetical one, say, yes, we agree with the new front line and that's it. Russia would pocket all this without NATO readiness to admit Ukraine as a full-fledged member under Article 5 protection.
That's Ukrainian military expert Mykola Belisikov. He was speaking with Natalia Churikova of VOA's Ukrainian service. And speaking of Western support, it was announced by the British Ministry of Defense on Friday that Britain is sending around 200 air defense missiles to Ukraine to help protect civilians and infrastructure from Russian drones and bombing. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The climate crisis comes to Shanghai. That story in a few minutes. Now, most observers would agree, it's been a grim year. In the Middle East, years of simmering tensions broke into an intense war between Hamas and Israel in the Gaza Strip. This after Hamas fighters crossed into Israel, killing 1,200 people. Israel's military response forced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to flee their homes and has killed more than 20,000 people in just over 2 months, leaving the bulk of the region displaced, according to the United Nations. In Ukraine, a months-long counteroffensive against the Russian invasion has wound up in a stalemate, but the fighting continues to kill thousands of Ukrainians and Russians. News outlets focused much of their attention on these two wars, but Joseph Siegel, a research director at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that an explosion of violence was also occurring in Africa, especially in Sudan.
Now, this is a country of 45 million people. It had had its share of challenges, but it had been mostly stable, and for this conflict to emerge between rival military units and commanders has really capsized a very important country in Northeast Africa and has caused millions of people to be displaced, tens of thousands of people to lose their lives. And you know, it really opens up, you know, a vacuum in that part of the continent. Sudan has 7 bordering countries. It also links the Arab world with Africa. And so it's had huge impacts for the continent. And as it remains unresolved and continues to deteriorate, we could expect that we're going to feel ramifications for that into 2024. I think the other big conflict on the continent that we really need to keep an eye on is in the Sahel. And there we've seen a continued escalation of militant Islamist group attacks in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. And so there really doesn't seem to be an end in sight, which in turn is causing massive levels of dislocation. In fact, Africa saw a record level of forcibly displaced people, about 40 million people.
That's a lot of people. And that you're not talking just Sudan, you're talking other countries too, right?
I'm talking about the continent, yes. And so it continues the trend we've seen over the past 6 or 7 years. You know, most of it's conflict related, though.
And it wasn't just the civil wars and coups that people are worried about. It's also the hottest year on record. And droughts and floods were both big, huge problems in several countries in Africa. That has caused the displacement of millions of people too, right?
It's true. We're seeing more and more direct effects from climate change. You know, Africa is at the epicenter of a lot of these changes. As you mentioned, it's getting hotter, drier. We're seeing more floods in some places. As the oceans warm, we're seeing more cyclones hit, especially East Africa. And this is causing more displacement of populations. People are moving to cities. It's feeding other forms of instability that we're seeing on the continent, including human trafficking and other sorts of illicit trafficking that are happening.
I found it a little surprising because of the attention of the Gaza Hamas Israel war and the Russia Ukraine war that in its annual emergency watch list, the International Rescue Committee did not put either one of those places at the top of its list. It put Sudan at the top of its list.
That is commendable, I think, on the part of the International Rescue Committee, because Sudan has largely been overlooked from these other obviously very important conflicts. Sudan, you know, is a country of 45 million people that is basically becoming a failed state, and with implications for all of its neighboring countries, there's 7 different neighboring countries with Sudan. They're all reeling from the effects of that conflict.
That's Joseph Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. And following up on Carol's interview about violence in Africa, there is diplomacy too. African leaders participated in several summits in 2023 to foster connections with counterparts from around the world. Mohamed Youssef reports on Africa's efforts to increase its clout on the world stage as issues elsewhere capture the world's attention.
Africa seeks to become a focus of global power and draw the attention of influential nations seeking to build political and economic relations with the 54 countries on the continent. In the past 12 months, African leaders have visited European Union headquarters in Brussels, as well as India, Russia and the United States, Saudi Arabia, South Africa and Turkey. They have also met with the Chinese President Xi Jinping in South Africa to discuss China's Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative, climate change financing, business and trade deals, global peace and security. Professor Chachanya Igoti Chacha, an expert in diplomacy and international relations, says Africa is an important player in global affairs and that countries would like to engage with the continent on several issues.
They are making these meetings happen because they want to create strategies on how they can continue assuring the African states that they are friends of the Africans, and consequently expecting that African countries will be able to continue relating with them amicably. And of course, they expect a lot of economic gains and political goodwill.
Some experts, however, have described some of the summits African leaders attended as gatherings that lack substance and perpetuate power imbalances in international political systems. with conflicts like Russia's war in Ukraine and the Israel-Hamas war. Political experts say international gatherings provide a means for some countries to seek Africa's support. Paul Melly is a consulting fellow with the Africa program at Britain's Chatham House, a research organization. He says Africa can be an influential voice in venues like the United Nations, where countries vote on political and security issues.
There's a very simple numerical fact. Africa, depending on how you count them, you're looking at, what, around 50 votes at the UN. That's quite a lot of arguing power. So, I mean, obviously, there are other continents that also have quite a few countries in them. But I think one of the things that stands out about Africa is that it's a continent where there is, in very loose terms, there is a bit of a culture of collective action. That's quite a lot of votes and quite a lot of political leverage.
Experts say they expect more countries to engage with Africa in coming years. Chacha, however, says the countries on the continent will need to engage more among themselves.
So they will remember 2023 as a year when they made so many interactions with the other international countries and foreign countries, and they will now remember that what they have to learn to do very fast is to network within themselves in order for the other years which are coming, they should have one voice.
Some countries like France have expanded their approach in dealing with Africa, not only inviting its leaders but also its youth, women, activists and business people to foster good relations. Tensions, however, remain between France and some of its former colonies in Africa. They include Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, which have kicked out French forces. Coups have also occurred in the three African nations, which recently formed a defense alliance with the aim of fighting jihadists. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally today, the climate crisis has brought terrible storms, devastating drought, wild temperature fluctuations, and more to many parts of the globe. And while not nearly as dramatic as any of those, the people in Shanghai are also experiencing climate change. Reuters' Rachel Graham has the story.
Some of Shanghai's best-known landmarks disappeared behind a haze of fog on Friday, leaving Chinese year-end holidaymakers bracing for possible transport disruptions. The Weather Bureau warned that the heavy fog would shroud areas from Hebei province in the north to Shanghai in the south for more than 24 hours. The Central Meteorological Observatory issued its first red warning for fog since 2017. Shanghai residents were unaccustomed to seeing their city like this.
It's definitely different. In this hazy weather, I can no longer see the Shanghai Centre Tower, which is the tallest building in Shanghai. As I look from the Puxi to Pudong side, the Oriental Pearl Tower is also faintly visible.
Some of the city's ferry routes were temporarily suspended. Some sections of highways and a bridge to a container port were temporarily closed. Dense fog was predicted in parts of Hebei, Shandong, Anhui, Jiangsu and Shanghai, leading to low visibility of less than 50 metres in some areas. More than 600 flights were delayed in various cities, tracking app Flightmaster showed. The severe weather was due to high humidity and poor atmospheric diffusion conditions, forecasters said. Conditions were expected to improve from Saturday evening, with a cold wave of air expected to blow over the country. China has experienced a year of climate extremes. Last week, most of the country was hit by a cold snap that rewrote records with sub-freezing temperatures. In the summer, scorching heat breached 125 degrees Fahrenheit in the northwest. Summer storms also brought record rainfall to Beijing and flooding elsewhere.
That's Rachel Graham of Reuters reporting. And that's going to end today's program, the final show of 2023. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening and Happy New Year. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.